So today's October 17th, and it's our second Melton class. We're doing Love, Lust, and Longing, Men and Women in the Talmud. And today's material is certainly connected to last week, but it's a separate story. You missing something? I don't have it. Anything you need, I'll send it to you.
Right.
Just to remind everyone, last week we saw the beautiful, idyllic story of the romance and marriage of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva actually had a marriage romance not only to Rachel, his wife, but he also had quite a marriage to the Torah. Because if you remember, he got married and left his wife for altogether how many years? 24 years.
24 and then
another. Oh, 12 and 12. Yeah, 24. Yeah, 12. So it's not just he was married to his wife, he was married to the Torah to a certain degree.
Hatan
Torah. And that tension between marriage to a spouse and marriage to the Torah is the subject of the stories and the sources we'll see today. Here we go. So the first source is from the Tosefta in Tractate Yevamot. The Tosefta is a collection of Braitot. If you don't remember what a Braita is, a Braita, well, the word Braita means external. A Braita is an external source, external relative to what? External
Mishnah?
To the Mishnah. When the Mishnah was codified by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, in the year 200 of the Common Era, all of the material of the Oral Law of Torah Sheba'al Peh that he didn't include in the Mishnah, it's all called Braita. It's all called external. Some of the Braitot are collected in books called Midrash. Some of the Braitot are brought in the Talmud. And some of the Braitot are collected in a book called the Tosefta. So the Tosefta, you can say, is parallel to the Mishnah. As material that's been left out of the Mishnah and later collected in order not to lose it. So in the Tosefta, on Tractate Yevamot, we find the following amazing exchange. Look at this. Rabbi Akiva says, anyone who commits murder diminishes the image of God. Now, what does it mean, diminish the image of God? Not 100% clear. It means that it blemishes the image of God. It takes away from the image of God. It's an affront to God. So to commit murder is not just to kill a human being, it's an affront to God. As it says, one who spills the blood of a man, because of that man, his blood will be spilt. For in the image of God he made man. That's a verse, by the way, from this week's Torah portion, Parshat Noach. And it says, if you spill the blood of God, because of the man you killed, your blood has to be spilt, you should be punished measure for measure. Why? For in the image of God, he made man. Because when you killed a man, you did something bad to God. It's like you killed God. But every person has the divine image in him. So it's not just to kill the man. You diminished God's image. You hurt God's image. That's what Rabbi Akiva says. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who is a younger colleague of Rabbi Akiva, anyone who does not engage in procreation diminishes the divine image. It's not just that you kill someone, but even if you refrain from creating children, that's also a certain affront to God. For it says, for in the image of God he made man, that's the same verse we just brought, and it's written immediately after, immediately following, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Right? It says, image of God he made man, and you should make more children. So if you don't make more children, you're not allowing the divine image to be multiplied on the earth. So it's an affront to God's image. Fantastic ideas, right? Very fascinating.
What is this saying then about Rabbi Akiva if he left his wife for these long
That's exactly
years?
Where we're going. That's exactly where we're going. You got it,
Barbara. But in fact, didn't Rabbi Akiva start to study when he was 40? He had already had children.
Well, there are different versions of the story. But at least in one version, it looks like he just left before.
I learned somewhere that he didn't really begin to study in depth until he was 40.
Well, the thing is, remember we talked last week that many of the Talmudic Agadot stories are not to be taken as history. They're stories that are constructed to teach a lesson. And there are many, many there are many conflicting stories concerning Rabbi Akiva.
But I thought he had children.
There are conflicting stories. We don't know Rabbi Akiva. We know the different stories about him.
Oh, we don't know that he had children?
We don't know anything.
We know
there are different conflicting stories about Rabbi Akiva. Some might be historical. Some are constructed in order to teach us moral lessons. And sometimes they teach conflicting lessons, depending on who wrote the story. That's a bit of a generalization,
but
it's true that contraception is understood to be a serious issue that you have to think about under certain circumstances, because diminishing the divine image. So now, the third opinion, not just Rabbi Akiva, not just Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Ben Azai, a contemporary of those two rabbis. Ben Azai says, anyone who does not engage in procreation is a murderer. You know what it said? Anyone who doesn't engage in procreation is a murderer. And also diminishes the divine image. For it says, one who spills the blood of a man, because of that man his blood will be spilled, for in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. And he connects all the ideas. It says, be fruitful and multiply. It says, don't murder, and it says God's image. He connects them all. So if you don't be fruitful and multiply, you're in the category of murderer and of someone who's not respecting God's image. That's a strong statement. And obviously, it's meant to be a little bit hyperbole. We don't put people in jail and execute them for not procreating, but he wants to make a point. It's really important to get married and procreate.
It took us two to marry.
It certainly does.
Is it, and yeah.
But you have to make an effort to get married and procreate.
Yes.
But wait, all this is just background to the point. The point's the next paragraph. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said to Ben Azai, Ben Azai, words are fine when accompanied by practice. There are those who interpret well and practice well, right? Some people, they do the right thing, and they also talk very nicely. There are those who practice well but do not interpret well. Some people practice Judaism, but they're not meant to give sermons and to teach fine. You interpret well but do not practice well. Because Ben Azai was a bachelor.
Oh, wow.
He never got married. And he said that if you don't get married, you diminish the divine image and you're a murderer. How can he say that? He's accusing himself. How can you say that? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, Ben Azai, if you don't get married, at least don't say such nice things about people who are married. How could you say that? In English, we call it a hypocrite. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah accuses Ben Azai of being one big hypocrite. And even adding fuel to the fire by making all these drashot about how great it is to be married. Ben Azai said to him, what shall I do? My soul desires Torah.
Well,
let the world be sustained by the efforts of others. Let others get married. We have to examine exactly what he said. So he says, what shall I do? In other words, he says, look, it's not in my hands. I am constrained by something. I'd like to get married, I can't. Why can't I? Because my soul desires Torah. And the word in Hebrew here for desire is cheshek, which is the same word used for passion between a man and a wife. I can't get married because I'm married to the Torah. Now, exactly what does he mean? Perhaps he means that I have such passion for study that I have no room in my heart to make a connection to another human being. Or perhaps he means I just don't have any time, not enough room in my heart.
It sounds more like Paul in Christianity. It sounds like.
So, you know, I very rarely disagree with Chip because he always says such
good things. You disagree with that?
But it's really important you brought that up, but I'm going to disagree.
All right.
So Chip said it sounds like Paul in the New Testament. It does, but it doesn't. Because it's certainly true that in the New Testament and in many later strands of Christianity, you have that deep Roman sensibility that there's an upper and there's a lower. The upper is the intellectual, the spiritual, the godly, and that's good and that's beautiful. And then there's the lower, the physical, the vulgar, the dirty, the sinful. And we should, as much as possible, refrain from the vulgar and be involved in the exalted, such that the proper way is to try to refrain from marriage and refrain from the physical and refrain from those things that are just so
but also
animal.
Paul,
let me finish the point. Okay, I'll let you speak.
Said
there's a conflict there between the intellectual and the physical, but it's a conflict in which one is good and one is bad. Now, most men, they have a sexual desire. They have to get married. We let them get married, but it's an accommodation, right? It's a compromise. What can you do? The priests don't get married because they're on the higher level. The common people let them get married, but you should really try and refrain. Ben Azai doesn't say that there's anything wrong with getting married. He doesn't say that I refrain from getting married because I'm on a higher level and I leave that vulgar stuff for other people. He doesn't say that at all. Ben Azai has a conflict between marriage and Torah, but it's not a conflict of this is good and this is bad, but I do the bad because I'm pulled to it. No, the opposite. He said they're both good. That's what I emphasize in this text. They're both good. It's good, it's proper to get married. It's not a sin, it's a mitzvah. But there's also a mitzvah to learn Torah, and I feel a certain psychological, emotional conflict between them. I just don't have the energy, on some level, to do both. Either because I just don't have passion for a woman, because all my passion is for the Torah. Or perhaps I just don't have time. Or perhaps I just don't have the money, because I'm so involved in Torah. But whatever it is, there's a conflict.
That is certainly true. But Paul says in another place in the New Testament though that if you get married, it will distract you from your service of God. It will distract you, be involved in providing for the wife and look out for her needs. And it'll detract from
your. That's what you meant.
That's what I meant.
Okay,
yeah.
So then I have to agree.
Would you please refresh my memory? At one point, you had taught us, I think, about Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? But when they went off and just studied and removed themselves, was that a temporary situation?
Okay, so the Nazarite is temporary, but the Nazarite is not about refraining from sexuality.
What about the Essenes?
It's about refraining from drinking wine, and it's refraining from contact with the dead, and it's refraining from cutting the hair, but it's not refraining from sexuality.
So they could still be married.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting in Catholicism, since it's the way they think that, you know, the higher purpose of the priests and all like that, that that's the good and they don't get married. But yet they encourage all their parishioners to have many children.
I can't speak for... Once you're married, it's obviously a good thing to have a lot of children, right?
Well,
you're already there.
In the original Judaism... which is now considered Orthodox, women were segregated from men during times of prayer. And they couldn't sit in the same place. They couldn't study together. So there was always this feeling in Judaism that women distracted men from this high level of prayer. And today, in both conservative and reform, women join the men. That feeling is no longer believed by them, but in the people who practice Orthodox Judaism, that feeling obviously is still there.
And therefore?
Well, I'm just saying that they don't think you can't be married, but they do feel that you have to separate this high level of prayer from women.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the contact with women. It means there might be a tension.
It's distracting.
It's distracting, but it's not something that should be refrained from. It just has its proper...
At the time,
fine, but that doesn't mean, therefore, men shouldn't get married. The opposite.
He
was saying it's a value to get married. That's what I want to emphasize.
In fact, just the opposite. I would think that by being married, they have more time to study because the woman participates in taking care of a lot of the obligations of the house, maybe getting a job, bringing income into the family. All of that gives the man more time to study.
Just like Rabbi Akiva's wife, according to the story. Right.
So, I mean, I think that, I mean, there was a when I was growing up, and my father was very Orthodox, my mother wasn't, but he still had a lot of the very Orthodox views. His feelings at that time, although they changed, were that better to get married early if you were a woman, and better to get married early if you were a man.
And we'll get to that right now. That's exactly where we're going.
Because if a man wasn't married, he'd be thinking about sex.
That's the next page. That's the next page. Hold on to your horses. It's right there. It's right there. But just to summarize where we are now, in this text of Ben Azai, we have presented to us the tension between two values. Not between something that's a value and something that's not, but something that's two values. And again, they're both a matter of desire. They're mostly a matter of passion. They both require all of your emotional input. And Ben Azai is the hypocrite who's not able to live with both in the same time. He has to do one but not the other. Whereas what about Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the others? They're trying to live with both values at the same time, right? They're scholars and they're married. They believe that procreation is an extremely important value. They believe that Torah is an extremely important value, and they're trying to live with both values. Rabbi Ben Azai cannot manage the tension. He has one but not the other. Okay, so now we get to exactly what Dorothy was bringing up. How did you know? The Babylonian Talmud Tractate Kiddushin, page 29b. By the way, this is a passage I used to teach the first year students for 15 years in the institution called Nishmat, which was for women from America coming to Israel to learn Talmud. This is part of what I used to teach them in the first year class. Our rabbis taught. Of course, we did it in Hebrew and Aramaic. We're doing it now in English. Our rabbis taught. If one has before him the commandment to study Torah, and the commandment to marry a wife. In other words, they're both commandments, and one has gotten to the age in which they're both relevant. His intellect has developed, and sexually he's ready to get married. What do you do? What do you do first? And this is a question asked concerning many mitzvot, when you have a conflict between two important values, which do you do first? What's the answer? The halacha is, end of the second line, he should first study and then marry. First, study, and get married later. But if he cannot live without a wife, he should first marry and then study. And that obviously means sexually. It means sexual passion. If he cannot put off getting married, then he should first marry and then study. So what do we see? So the value, it looks like, is study should come first. Why should study come first? Because once you get married, it's going to be hard to put your full passion into study. Because you're involved emotionally with your wife, and there's also the economic burden. It's hard. So first you get your bachelor's and your master's degree. You do your doctorate. Then when you're older, you can marry. But if you just can't put it off because the sexual energy is just overcoming you, so then you get married first, and then whatever energy you have left, you study. So I just want to point out here that if you read between the lines, you understand that for some people who have to get married first, for them, not being married is a state of profanity, and being married is a state of holiness. Because if he gets married, because he can't do without it, we're talking about sexual energy and sexual passion, we're talking about sexual fantasies, getting married is a way to deal with that. In other words, it's good. The marriage is holiness, and the non-marriage creates a situation of profanity. That's a very different view than, for example, a classic approach of the dichotomous relationship between body and soul, which body is bad and soul is good. We're saying that for some people, answering the passions of the body is the right, the proper, the holy thing to do, the right thing to do. That's the end of the ancient source. That's the end of the Braita. Remember, previous class, Braita is from before the year 200 of the Common Era. Rav Yehuda said in Shmuel's name, Shmuel is after the year 200. And Rav Yehuda and Shmuel, they are Babylonian rabbis after the year 200.
The Amoraim.
Amoraim. Yeah. The halakha is a man first marries and then studies. What? They're contradicting the authoritative source. That's a very powerful thing. You don't do that lightly. And we're going to ask later, how could they contradict the source? The source said what you do is study Torah first, and they say the ideal is to marry first and then study. They're changing all around. And we have to ask, how did the Babylonian rabbis, on what basis, why did they change things around?
They knew about men's sexual...
That's one possibility. It could be that in Babylonia, there was more of a consciousness... either for objective reasons or not for objective reasons. Could be the culture had more sex in it. Could be it was just their own perception. It could be there's a sense that everyone has to get married first because there's no way to deal with sexual passion. That's possible. Or it could also be that economic conditions were better. And it was possible to get married without it interfering with your studies. Because your father-in-law could pay for it, because your wife could work. It could be the economically conditioned. We don't know. It was different in Babylonia.
Maybe part of it could have been that they were worried about intermarriage?
No, I don't think so.
No,
not in that society. Not in that society. We have no record of such a thing. So the Babylonian culture reversed the halakha, and again, that's a very, very uncommon thing. It must be that there was some good reason, either economic or some perception of the role of sexuality in life. Rabbi Yochanan said, Rabbi Yochanan is the land of Israel, and he's in the same time as Shmuel, after the year 200. He said, with a millstone around the neck, shall one study Torah? What do you mean? What are you telling me? Get married first and then marry and then learn. How could you do that? A millstone probably refers to economic burden, and perhaps he's saying in the land of Israel where I live, there's no way to get married and then learn Torah. It's just too difficult economically. Or perhaps the millstone doesn't mean literally economic burden. Perhaps it's a figure of speech for the emotional burden. And if you're married and developing a relationship with a wife and having a family, you just don't have the passion and the time to study Torah as you should. And by the way, of course, these ancient conflicts are present in our own lives. People always debate, should I get married first? Should I go to graduate school? Should I? It's always there. The same conflict. So Rabbi Yochanan is reflecting the more ancient approach that you first study. And he lives in the land of Israel, whereas the Babylonians are saying, no, yeah, things are different, you have to first get married. And then the Talmud says what I just said. It says, at the top of the next page, yet they do not differ. The one refers to ourselves, that's the Babylonian Talmud speaking, the other to those who reside in Israel. The authors of the Babylonian Talmud understood, they don't say what the difference is, but then they said there are different cultural norms. Again, perhaps it's economic, perhaps it's perception of the role of sexuality, doesn't say. Now, I'm going to read some stories that we can just breeze through. They're interesting, certainly interesting. Rav Chista praised Rav Hamnuna as a great man in the presence of Rav Huna. So I'm Rav Chista, and I said to Chip, who's Rav Huna, you know, I said Rav Hamnuna, who says Dorothy, she's really great. You should meet her someday. Chip, you should meet that woman.
Yeah, I'm glad I have met her.
Said he to him, so said Chip to me, when he visits you, when Dorothy visits, bring him to me. Right? So Chip says, whenever you see that Dorothy, send her in. When he arrived, in other words, when Dorothy came, I sent her to Chip. And Chip saw that he had no head covering. She wasn't wearing a kippah. "Why have you no head covering?" asked he. "Because I'm not married," was the reply. And here's the source for what we know to be the ancient Babylonian custom, is they only wore kippot when they got married, not before.
Is like some people today would only wear talis.
Same thing. Thereupon, Rav Huna turned his face away from Rav Huna, the older rabbi, when he saw that Dorothy was not wearing kippah, he turned his face away. He's disgusted when he hears that Dorothy is not married. "See to it that you do not appear before me again before you get married," said he. That's the end of the story. And the narrator says, Rav Huna was thus in accordance with his views, for he had said, "He who is 20 years old and is not married spends all his days in sin." So here you have it explicitly, that the reason for the Babylonian insistence that young men get married before they go study is because otherwise you spend all your days in sin. And then the narrator says, "In sin? Can you really think so? Ah, but say he spends all his days in sinful thoughts." So it's more explicit. Not that he's really sinning, but it's all about sexual fantasy. It's all about being involved in sexual thoughts, and there's no way to avoid that for these young men except if you get them married early. And therefore, if I see someone who's not married, I'm not going to have any Torah conversations with him, says Chip. Because that's... No, you have to first get married, then we can learn Torah together. And that's the Babylonian approach. Even though it's in conflict with the ancient source, you have to get married first. And aren't they disturbed or bothered by the fact that once you're married, you have a burden, a financial burden? That apparently didn't bother them so much. And we already know why, from the story of Rabbi Akiva and his wife. Is that story supposed to teach you that you can get married and not have a great economic burden because you leave your wife and let her fend for herself. Right? That's what the story was last week, right? Mm-hmm. Vara's looking at me. She wasn't here last week.
No, I wasn't. Right. I'm just curious, and you might have discussed it last week. Doesn't this go against the responsibilities listed in a ketubah?
It certainly does, and we're going to get to that. It certainly does. Right. Yes. Rava said, he's a Babylonian rabbi, and the school of Rabbi Ishmael taught likewise, until the age of 20, the Holy One, blessed be He, sits and waits. When will He take a wife? As soon as one attains 20 and is not married, he exclaims, "Blasted be his bones." In other words, it's a real bad thing to delay marriage to such a ripe old age as 20. Rav Chista said, "I did better than my colleagues in that I married at 16. And had I married at 14, I would have said to Satan, 'An arrow in your eye.'" In other words, it seems to imply that marrying at 16, I was partially able to overcome the Satan, but not completely. Had I married at 14, then I would have completely overcome the Satan. So what are we talking about? We're talking about development of puberty and of sexual development. The earlier you get married, the more chance you have of completely circumventing Satan, who is here a symbol of sexual passion. Right? So that's what the Babylonian rabbis are concerned with. So on the one hand, they have a deep sense of the allure of sexuality and the problematics that that creates for young men. And on the other hand, they seem not to be concerned with the economic burden of getting married, or less concerned about that. So they have the students get married and then go and learn Torah.
Interesting about he doesn't cover his head until he gets married.
Mm-hmm.
When did that change? I mean, now men cover their heads
right.
all the time, even young boys.
Right. That seems to have been the custom in the time of the Talmud, and it was a slow development of over the course of 1,000 years that the custom of Jewish men covering their heads constantly developed. Even going back 100 years ago in Germany, many observant Jewish men only covered their heads for blessings and for prayer. Right. In any case, it's very different than the custom today. Today, people seem to assume that it's more important for a man to cover his head than to wear tzitzit. Whereas halachically, it's just the opposite. The covering of the head is just a custom that the ancient rabbis didn't even follow unless they were married, whereas the wearing of tzitzit is a biblical commandment. Right? So today, things are completely upended. Okay, so now we're going to switch to Babylonian Talmud Tractate Ketubot. We were in Tractate Kiddushin, now we're going to Ketubot to continue the same discussion. Here we go. The Mishnah says, if a man forbade himself by vow to have intercourse with his wife, Beit Shammai ruled he can do so up to a maximum of 2 weeks. Either he got mad at his wife, or he wanted to prove something to his friend, and he made a vow, you're allowed to refrain up to 2 weeks, but not more. Beit Hillel ruled only 1 week. You can't refrain more, and if you vow for more than that, you have to divorce your wife and give her her ketubah. Of course, if she wants, it is to say. He says, you don't have to, but if the wife says, I don't accept that vow, we're not going to have intercourse for a whole year, she is legally allowed to go to the Beit Din and say he has the opportunity to pay me mehal ketubah, which could be like whole life savings, right? So there's a great financial incentive that the man does what the halacha says, which is only a week or 2 weeks according to Beit Shammai. So of course this is based on the assumption that intimacy is a normal, accepted, proper and commanded part of life. You can't refrain from it. You are wronging your spouse. And of course, then we'll ask, well, how did Rabbi Kiva stay away for 24 years? Not just 24 days, 24 years! Right? We have a tension here. Students may go away to study the Torah without the permission of their wives for up to a period of 30 days. I mean, if it's a vow, it could be 2 weeks or 1 week. So, for the purpose of study, you're allowed even for 30 days, but not more than 30 days. And what it means is that if you stay away and study Torah for more than 30 days, your wife is allowed to demand her whole ketubah, all the money. Labor is only for 1 week, right? If you're a laborer, you can stay away to go to work for a week, but not more than that. By the way, you should all be looking at me.
Yeah.
Right. This applies to me.
Yeah. Your wife asked you for a divorce yet?
Pretty close.
Oh. I'm sorry.
But according to this, she's allowed. But it said without permission. Right? All this is without permission. The times for conjugal duty prescribed in the Torah are, and the Torah, we won't look at the verse, says that among the obligations of a man to his wife are not just to feed and clothe, they're also intimacy. The emotional and physical connection is part of marriage, and it's a legal part of marriage. It's in the ketubah, by the way. It says that those are the obligations of a man to his wife. And then it says, how frequently? For men of independence, we don't know exactly what that means, every day. For laborers, twice a week. For ass drivers, once a week. For camel drivers, once in 30 days. For sailors, once in 6 months. Why? Sailors, they have to stay away. That's their work. Camel drivers, they go on long trips. Ass drivers go on shorter trips. These are the rulings of Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, that's the end of the Mishnah. Gemara. Quotes from the Mishnah that students may go away to study, etc. And we said they're allowed to go away without permission for how many days?
30 days.
Yeah. And then the Talmud asks, for how long may they go away with the permission of their wives? For as long as they desire. Now, of course, we all understand that both today and all the more so 2,000 years ago, the difference between permission and without permission is not so clear. Right? Especially in a male-dominated society, What does it mean to get permission from your wife to go away? You can force her to agree to certain circumstances, or she can give permission against her will. So clearly it looks like by asking the question, how long can you stay away without permission, the Talmud is looking for a way to allow the students to stay away for a longer amount of time. And it's not necessarily thinking about the good of the wife. So then, okay, they can stay away as long as they want, but the Talmud asks, but what's the proper behavior? Really, what should you do? Even if she agrees, but how long should you stay away? So Rav said, and Rav is in Babylonia, 1 month studying and 1 month at home. Go back and forth. And apparently the assumption is that economically you'll do well. Perhaps the women took care of the home and worked, it could be. Go away to study and then come home. For it is said in the scripture, it brings a proof from the book of Chronicles. Let's skip the proof. Rabbi Yochanan, however, Rabbi Yochanan is in the land of Israel. He said 1 month studying and 2 months at home. Right? So let's think about that. Rabbi Yochanan was the one that said that you should study first and then get married. Because with a millstone around your neck, how can you study Torah? So he seems to be saying what you should really do is spend a few years studying and then get married. But if you did get married, because he had no choice, then you have an obligation to be at home more than you're away. Now, Rabbi Yochanan seems to be against this matter of just leaving your wife stranded. The first thing you have to do is study, then get married. And when you get married, be really married. But if you went against the grain and you decided to get married before you studied, you can go away, but you have to spend more time at home than you did studying. So Rabbi Yochanan doesn't seem to accept the story we read last week, of Rabbi Akiva going away for 24 years. It's not an ideal for him. Because he was in the camp of the rabbis of Israel. The first thing you should really do is study, then get married. When you're married, really married. And he's against the Babylonian way of getting you married and leaving your wife to study. But if you did get married first, go away to study only for a month and then come home for 2 months. Your main base has to be, if you're married, you're really married. And now the Talmud says the following. These are the words of Rabbi Eliezer. Remember, the whole Mishnah ended, these are the rulings of Rabbi Eliezer. Rav Barun is stated in the name of Rav. The halakha follows Rabbi Eliezer. Fine. Rav Ada bar Ahava, and of course Ahava means love. Rav Ada, the son of love, was a man of love. But we wonder, is it love of Torah or love of wife? What is it hinting to? State in the name of Rav. This is the Vira Eliezer only, but the sages ruled students may go away to study without the permission of their wives for 2 or 3 years. Right? The Mishnah said only for 30 days. But the man whose name is Love said you can go away for 2 or 3 years. And that, of course, is the beginning of this, the Babylonian thing we've been talking about, of getting married first and then studying. What does it mean, then studying? It means leaving your wife. So you get married, you satisfy your sexual needs to a certain degree, and then you leave for 2 or 3 years and come back every once in a while. Rav stated the rabbis relied on Rav Ada bar Ahava and act accordingly, and that is the Babylonian custom that we started talking about last week. The ideal is to first get married and then leave your wife. Now look at the next story. Okay, this is good. Rav Rechume. Rechume means love in Aramaic. The fact that one rabbi's name is Ada bar Ahava, Ahava is love, the next rabbi is named Rav Rechume, the rabbi of love, clearly it means that these are not stories that just happened, so they recorded them. These are constructed stories that teach you a lesson. Rav Rechume, who was frequenting the school of Rava at Mechoza, Mechoza is a Babylonian city, used to return home on the eve of every Yom Kippur. Which means probably he came home for Yom Kippur and Sukkot, then he went back to the yeshiva for another year. Right? He spent 2 or 3 weeks at home every year, which is the Babylonian model. Get married early and then go and learn Torah. Come back every 2 or 3 years. He was a good guy. He came back every year for a few weeks. On one occasion, he was so engrossed in his studies that he forgot to return home. Right? He got involved in a really exciting Milton class on the morning of before Yom Kippur, and he looks at his watch. Ah, no time left to get home for Yom Kippur. I have to stay in the yeshiva this year. Now, if getting involved in your studies on the morning of Yom Kippur, when Yom Kippur is another 10 hours, if getting involved in your studies that morning means you won't be able to make it home, it indicates that you don't live the other side of the globe. Right? It looks like he lived like a 4 or 5 hour donkey ride. So he didn't go far away. Which means that he really could have come home every weekend. If it's just, but he purposely didn't. To completely devote himself to study without the distractions of life at home. Right? His wife was expecting him every moment, right? It's the afternoon already, and the fast is coming, and every year he comes home. And she's expecting him. It means she's gotten into this routine every single year. He's been away, and every single year he comes back. He is coming soon, he is coming soon. As he did not arrive, she became so distraught that tears began to flow from her eyes. He was at that moment sitting on the roof of the Beit Midrash and studying. The roof collapsed under him and he was killed.
What was he doing on a roof?
No, no.
Why in the world would anybody study on a roof?
No. You're misunderstanding. They normally were on the roof. It was very hot out. The roofs were flat.
Oh.
He was studying in the Beit Midrash, okay. But on the roof. The roof collapsed under him and he was killed. So what's the moral of the story? What's it trying to tell us?
Better get home to your wife.
That's right.
That hurt her feelings. Yeah.
Right. Remember we learned last week in the other class, those who were there, that the gates of hurt feelings are never closed. Remember in the story? And Rabbi Eliezer had his feelings hurt and...
Could he have walked?
Could have come home?
Yeah. No, walking.
Walked home.
Yeah.
He could have walked home, but he didn't realize what time it was.
Even in Yom Kippur, could he walk?
Could he have walked home on Yom Kippur? No.
No.
No, because there's the tchum. You're not allowed to walk more than 2,000 cubits outside of the city.
Okay.
Right. But it's not Yom Kippur yet.
Right.
It's still the afternoon, and he's studying. So, this story actually has a double message. Because we just read that the rabbis of Babylonia, they follow the ruling that you're allowed to stay away for 2 or 3 years. And that's what they follow. But they bring a story that tells us that that's what he followed, but it didn't work out well. So there's a tension here. The rabbis are advocating an approach of marrying early and then going away, but at the same time they realize that it hurts the spouse. And it deeply hurts the spouse. And hurts so badly that it might even be that some of these men deserve to die. But that's what we do. There's a real cultural tension here. A real cultural tension between two important values. Marriage, procreation, and satisfying the emotional needs of your spouse on the one hand. On the other hand, the love of Torah and the need to learn Torah. Neither of them are bad. They're both good values. How do you manage the tension? The way you manage the tension in Babylonia is get married and then go away and study. But the Talmud realizes that that solution is a big problem. It's the only solution they have. But it's fraught with difficulty. Real difficulty. See the next story. We'll read a paragraph and then the next story. How often are scholars to perform their marital duties? Rav Yehuda, in the name of Shmuel, replied every Friday night. This that bringeth forth fruit in its season. Rav Yehuda, and some say Rav Huna, or again, as others say, Rav Nachman states, this refers to a man who performs his marital duty every Friday night, and references particularly to scholars. But of course, on the other hand, these scholars are away and they're not coming back every Friday night. Right? Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Chiya, was the son-in-law of Rabbi Yanai. He went to study, and every Sabbath eve he came home. And we said that in the previous story, the Beit Midrash was perhaps only 4 or 5 hours away. It's not the other side of the world. So some went away for 2 or 3 years. Some came back every Yom Kippur. This one came back every Friday night. He did what this halakha said, right? Every Friday night. Whenever he arrived, the people saw a pillar of light moving before him, which is a really ambiguous metaphor. A pillar of light, it's like in the desert, some of them says God, he's a holy man, right? But others say it might be a phallic symbol. Perhaps he's only coming back to satisfy his sexual passion. Once he was so engrossed by his studies that he forgot to return home. Not seeing that sign, so the pillar of light didn't come back, the pillar of fire didn't come on Friday afternoon. Rabbi Yanai, we said he's the father-in-law, said to those around him, turn over his bed. For had Yehuda been alive, he would not have neglected the performance of his marital duties. Turning over the bed is a sign of mourning. Just like we cover the window or the mirrors today, yes. Turn over the bed, it's a sign of mourning. You're not allowed to sit on the bed, you have to sit right on the ground. Now, he didn't die, but his father thought he was dead because he didn't come home. He comes every Friday night. He didn't come. He must be dead. This remark was like an error that proceeded from the ruler. A verse from Ecclesiastes. For in consequence, Yehuda's soul returned to its eternal rest. Because his father-in-law said he must be dead, he died. Now, push comes to shove. What do we read? He didn't come home Friday night and he died. Just like the previous rabbi didn't come home on Yom Kippur and he died. Not a good record here, right? And again, we're being told, it looks like we're being told, that as good as the solution is of getting married and going away to study, it has its issues. And there seems to be a lack of sensitivity to the female spouse that the rabbis are aware of.
Maybe it's also saying that if you forget to do your obligations to your family because you're studying and you forget, that's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, there's a limit to how deep into this you're supposed to go when you know you have obligations to your family.
I hear what you're saying, and you're right. And that is part of the tension, because why are you going away? In order to completely engross yourself and not be distracted. But the very fact that you're completely engrossed causes you to lose sight of the other side of the tension. Again, we're talking here about a tension that doesn't seem to have a good resolution. And the rabbis have a solution, but that solution is in itself problematic. It gets worse, or better, however you look at it. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, that's Rabbi Judah the Prince, the editor of the Mishnah, was engaged in the arrangements for the marriage of his son into the family, Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra. It was agreed that he should spend 12 years in study. Let's see what that means from the next sentence. When the girl was led before him, before the prospective chatan, bridegroom, he said to them, let it be 6 years.
Must have been pretty.
Right. When they made her pass before him a second time, he said, I would rather marry her first and then proceed to the academy. Which means that the original idea was, get engaged, but don't get married. Get engaged, go away for 12 years, and then come back. Which means she's going to be waiting, unmarried, for 12 years. Now, even if she was only 12... 12 years later is 24. That's half of her life. If she was 20, 12 years later is 32. So he says, I'd rather get married first and then proceed to the academy. Now, if you remember the difference between the Land of Israel approach and the Babylonian approach, the people in the Land of Israel, like Rabbi Yochanan, they said, get study first and then get married. That, and this is in the land of Israel, this Rabbi Yehuda Hanassi. That was the plan, was to get engaged but not to get married. Just designate who she's going to marry and then go and study before marriage. That's what was planned. But the young man couldn't take it. So he did what we had read that the that there are men in Israel do, that if you can't help yourself, then get married first. And they followed the Babylonian custom getting married, but then going to study. So he said, I first want to get married, then I'll proceed to the academy. He felt abashed before his father, but the latter said to him, my son, you have the mind of your creator, for in scripture it is written, thou bringest them and planted them, and later it's written, let me make a sanctuary, I dwell among them. In other words, first get planted in life, and then make a sanctuary. First get married, and then go to a sanctuary, then study Torah, then fall in love with God. So his father comforted him that it's okay to get married first and then go off to study. After the marriage, he departed and spent 12 years at the academy. Did he come home? It doesn't say. Perhaps he came home a little bit, but basically was away for 12 years. By the time he returned, his wife had lost the power of procreation. That's pretty sad for her and for him. And also means the tension they were trying to work with of having both procreation and Torah, it didn't work. What shall we do, said Rabbi? That's the father-in-law, Rabbi Yehuda Hanassi. Should we order him to divorce or marry a younger girl? It would be said this poor soul waited in vain, the poor woman who waited 12 years. So it really looks like he never came home for 12 years. Were he to marry another woman, in other words, have a second wife, not divorce her and take another one, but have a second wife with her, it would be said the latter is his wife and the other is his mistress. He prayed for mercy to be vouchsafed for her and she recovered. So very nice, there was a miracle, but what is the story trying to say? Right? You don't rely on a miracle. Again, the same thing. The story is pointing out that there's something deeply problematic with this solution of getting married and then going off to study and leaving your wife as a married widow. I'm taking language from the story last week. A married widow. She's married, but she's not. Rabbi Hananya ben Chakinai was about to go away to study towards the conclusion of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's wedding. Wait for me, the latter said to him, until I'm able to join you. In other words, wait for the marriage to finish, then I'll go study with you. But I'm in the middle of the ceremony now, I can't go with you. He, however, did not wait for him. Excuse me.
Yeah,
Chip, keep reading. Yeah, read out loud on this thing.
He, however, did not wait for him, but went away alone and spent 12 years in the academy. By the time he returned, the streets of the town were altered, and he was unable to find the way to his home. Going down to the riverbank and sitting down there, he had a girl being addressed thus, Daughter of Hakinai, O daughter of Hakinai, fill up your pitcher and let us go. It is obvious, he thought, that the girl was ours, and he followed her.
Stop for a second, so he didn't know his own daughter. Right? That's pretty sad. Okay.
When they reached the house, his wife was sitting and sifting flour. She lifted up her eyes and seeing him, was so overcome with joy that her soul departed.
Not so good either.
Oh, God. O Lord of the universe, the husband prayed to him, this poor soul, is this her reward? And so he prayed for mercy to be vouchsafed to her, and she would revive. Rabbi Hama ben Bisa went away from home and spent 12 years at the house of study. When he returned, he said, I would not act as did Ben Hakina. He therefore entered the local house of study and sent word to his house.
He didn't surprise his wife. He sent a message that I'm here. But he still stayed away for 12 years. So this is the story. Many, many rabbis, seems this was the cultural phenomena, they went away to study, and the Talmud is encouraging that, the Babylonian Talmud, but at the same time, it is really aware of the problematics of it, of the lack of fairness vis-a-vis the wife, and also the fact that sometimes it just doesn't work out. These women, they die. They lose their power of procreation. And God is merciful, so they're revived. But again, we obviously understand that you can't rely on a miracle all the time.
Today it seems like the ones who want to go and study, they marry, and then the wife comes with them, though, to wherever,
right,
the yeshiva, wherever they're,
right,
studying. And the,
right,
wife works and makes a living, or the wife's parents support them.
Right.
I know one couple like that. And,
right.
And then he studies, but I mean...
Yeah, the best,
why,
of both worlds.
I guess they couldn't do that. I mean,
and why couldn't they do
right
that?
There
it could be that there was a sense that it's too distracting to be involved emotionally with a spouse and to have all the family burdens and tasks, that it's really proper to go and be married to the Torah completely. But the squaring of a circle was very problematic.
Seems so extreme to me.
Yes. Right, so extreme.
Seems like it would be,
yeah,
if they would have some moderation in that, it,
right,
looks a lot better than,
right,
being gone for 12 years,
yeah,
and then come home and the wife,
I understand,
dies, or it's too late to have children,
right,
and they can't fulfill that mitzvah that they're supposed to procreate.
But of course, from their perspective, this is exactly moderation. The extreme would be not getting married at all.
Yeah.
But I understand, I identify with what you're saying. Barbara?
If you were to put these laws or customs on a timeline, did they start during the Babylonian exile and then continue?
I don't know when they started, but we could surmise that they did begin in Babylonian, because the ancient sources from the land of Israel said, first go and study and then come and get married. That's what Rabbi Yochanan and the earlier sources, the Babylonian custom seems to have developed in Babylonia. We don't know exactly why. Again, we can theorize, perhaps because economic conditions allowed it, perhaps because of a sense that sexuality had to be consummated at a young age. But what we do know is that these customs continue for thousands of years. Right? In Europe in the 19th century, many men did get married and then go away to yeshiva. That absolutely was still a custom in the 19th century. And what Carol Ann mentioned is certainly the custom in many ultra-Orthodox communities in America today of getting married and then the wife and the family and the man going to the yeshiva together. You have that in Morristown in New York today, in Chabad. You have it in Lakewood in New Jersey. You have it in Baltimore in Maryland. And where else? I'm not sure where else in America. But those are centers that each have thousands of students. And of course, in Israel, you have it in tens of thousands of cases. And I'm not exaggerating.
Was there ever a custom where the young man went off and studied for whatever number of years and then came back and married a younger woman?
Well, we just saw a story that there was a suggestion like that.
Well, there was a suggestion that he divorced the wife.
That either divorce her?
He was divorced the wife. But I'm not talking about that. In other words, the guy doesn't get married. He goes off and studies. Now he's reached the point where he can educate his community or do whatever. And then he comes back and marries a younger woman who's able to...
Yes, that's what they did in the land of Israel. They went to a study...
But they would marry a younger woman.
Well, they wouldn't marry someone who couldn't have children anymore.
So they weren't engaged, left, and come back.
Right, in the land of Israel, Rabbi Yochanan's approach, first go and study, then another 15 or 20 years, in some cases it was that long, come back and marry a woman who's of the age of a procreation. Yes, so we absolutely have records of men 35 and 40 marrying women who are in their 20s. Absolutely, absolutely. So I guess we should end, and we pretty much covered the story. Why don't we just end with, let's remember now that the story we saw last week of Rabbi Akiva is in this context. I took it right from this story. In other words, it's an effort to Well, it's the one story that doesn't have any negatives involved in going away to study. The woman didn't die. She didn't lose her possibility of procreation. The man didn't die. So that's her Rebbe Akiva.
She gave permission, too.
She gave permission, right. That is meant as an ideal to show how the system works. And it's meant to be emulated. But as we see, there are many other stories that show you the problematics of it. And the whole thing ends with the following. Rav Yosef, the son of Rav, was sent by his father to study under Rabbi Yosef. There are two Yosefs there. One is Rav, one is Rabbi. They arranged for him to stay there for 6 years after his marriage. Having been there 3 years, and the eve of the Day of Atonement approaching, he said, I will go and see my family. He couldn't stay away for so long. It was hard for him. When his father heard of his premature arrival, he took up a weapon and went out to meet him. Because the father wanted him to stay away and become a scholar, and he wants to come home and be with his wife. Well, and that's not why you got married. I sent, got you married to go and study. You have remembered, he said to him, you're a whore. Now, as the father says, you're coming back just for sex? Go and study. Another version, he said to him, you remember your dove. A little bit of a nicer version. We don't remember what he really said. They get involved in a quarrel, and neither of them nor the other ate the last meal before the fast. And here you really see the conflict, right, between sexual fulfillment and study of Torah. That is to say, between love of woman and love of Torah. And that's the theme here. And as we see again, it doesn't always work out so neatly. It's complicated. Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, this was interesting.
You're okay with the after you drank the water? You're
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.